Hello, fair listeners. Last week we heard from Sarah about ancient trade routes. Today we'll take that knowledge, ship it to ourselves, snort coke off its mummified corpse, and unpack it into an awesome sci-fi or fantasy world. But first, Dave has joined us today, not only to help us build a world, but also to tell you about his collaborative story mapping software, Archivos.
Woo! Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Archivos.
You know,
man, I was not going to fuck it up, and then I fucked it up.
Archivos. However you want to pronounce that, I'm good with it, honestly.
Yeah. So tell us about what Archivos does.
Sure. Well, it's, you know, it's weird because this had been an idea that was in my brain for a long time. I'd been doing the Roundtable podcast, so I was brainstorming stories. Stories were very much in my head. And also concurrently, and for a long time before that, you know, theater major, gaming nerd. So story. It's what I live and breathe. It's my life's blood. So I'm looking at what was available online. I'm looking at wikis. I'm looking at my Word docs for the stories that I'm building or the games that I'm developing. And it's like, this is flat. This is, you know, when you look at a wiki for a novel series, for example, that's not how you think of that story. When you're writing a story or when you're reading a story, it's this orbiting mass of people and places and events all kind of melding together in context to each other. And there wasn't anything in the marketplace where a storyteller could actually see their story the way they think about it. So that's why I created Archivos, to give storytellers that opportunity to see the people and the places and the events of their stories in the context of that larger narrative, of that larger story world. So when you sign up for Archivos, and it's free, you can get a free account, gives you a free story world, fill that thing up with whatever you want. But you get there and there's nothing. So you create a character story element. You give it a name, short description, long description, blah, blah, blah. And then you create, okay, so this guy has a friend. Okay, so you create the friend. And here's where Archivos gets fun. You can then create relationships between those two story elements. So you can say this person is familiar with this person, or maybe it's his boss. So this person works for this person. You get to define the nature of the connection between those two story elements.
Okay.
And then you keep layering that in. So this event happened, you know, this dramatic event in this person's past, for example. So you create that event, put it on the timeline. So now we have a linear mapping of the narrative and say these two people participated in this event. So now all three of those elements are connected. And then you connect the event to a location. Now we've got geography factoring into the thing. So now the place is connected to the event, connected to the person, and it just builds and builds from there. So once you've built this network of association that defines the connections and the relationships between all these elements, then Archivos gives you these three display modes where you can actually view that network. The story web is like this. It's like a molecule. It's like here's your central character, and then all of these orbiting bits that are floating around, and you can see the connections between them. Mm-hmm. So you can see the association from one character to one place to one event, so on and so forth. The living map lets you do the same thing with geography. You upload a map, whether it's, you know, something you drew on a cocktail napkin or an actual Google map of whatever, or something you created in Incarnate or whatever. You upload that graphic, and then you can pin events and places onto that map. So you can see, you know, exactly how close, for example, how close is Ben Kenobi's hut from Mos Eisley spaceport? You know, I don't know.
Or the Lars moisture farm.
Yeah, exactly. And having a sense of that context from a storytelling standpoint gives you a sense of, you know, what it takes to move from point A to point B. In the context of our conversation last episode, you know, putting up a map of Asia and then putting down the stopping points, the various trade stopping points for the Silk Road, and being able to see that context laid out completely.
Going to the Sahara Desert and putting RIP tree somewhere.
RIP tree, yes, exactly. Dead tree killed by a drunk driver. And then you've got the timeline, which gives you that linear, that chronological progression of events. And you can actually, you know, create events inside of events. You could say, like, this was the Renaissance, and it went from here to here. And here are the significant events that happened inside the Renaissance. Ding it, ding it, ding it, ding it.
So you could map out like your whole timeline of your book and of like all of the crap that you've world built beforehand. So it's like a visual story Bible.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that's, you know, that's inevitably what you end up doing is, you know, all of that backstory that never makes it into the actual narrative, but is deeply informative of the characters and their choices. You can document that and it'll appear in the story web of that story. So you can at least always be aware. Oh yeah, that's right. He was trapped in a fire back when he was a kid. He's going to have a negative response to this big fire that's going on around it. Blah, blah, blah.
I'm looking at this and thinking this would have been useful for my nonfiction book, for which it is right now to start this.
Exactly. And that's the thing that excites me so much about Archivos is because, you know, history is just a story that actually happened, you know? So you can document historical elements. You can document, you know, scientific innovations.
If you're doing historical fiction or historical fantasy, but you're using things that happened in the real world and you want to document those as like events and places that are important along that and that time in that time period, you can map it that way and then be able to look at it and say, okay, well, I want this book in the series to occur here, this book to occur here. And exactly. Like you can already have that kind of mapped out. That's a really cool application for that.
Very much so. And, you know, I can see educational possibilities for this, having there be, you know, curriculum tied to this with pre and post tests and yada, yada. So, I mean, the vision for this is huge.
Speaking of the like wider applications, there is a collaborative aspect to it. Can you tell me more about that?
Absolutely. Well, there are multiple levels of subscription. The free level of subscription gives you one story setting that you can work with, which honestly is enough. I mean, really, for most people, when you're working on a story, you only need one story world. But as we all know, ideas tend to breed like tribbles or like gremlins when you get them wet. So you're going to have more stories. At the personal level, then you can have infinite story worlds, as many as you want. At the professional level, that's where you start getting into the collaborative features. You can invite other people to either view or to actually edit your story setting with you.
I love that.
So if you've got, you know, you're doing shared world writing, for example, and you want to have that story Bible foundation, you can link to all your participants and say, here's the story world we're working from. And that can be read only, so they can't change anything, or you can give them full editing capabilities and they can add and edit and delete as well.
And they need a subscription to have those editing capabilities?
Only the person who owns the story setting needs the professional level subscription.
Oh, wow. So somebody else could just have a free one and be invited to edit something.
Exactly.
For example, if we were to build one of the story soil worlds on Archivos, we could invite other people to collaborate and build onto that.
And it wouldn't cost them a dime. Absolutely.
That's amazing. Also, Adrian and I definitely need this because we've been building worlds together for 20 years and we've never had a reliable way to keep track of everything. We've tried. She has a character spreadsheet that's a thing of beauty, but we don't update it enough.
Yeah. We can definitely make that happen. And the other cool stuff that you can do with Archivos is you can embed the story views into your website. So you don't have to be in the Archivos URL. You can get this little embed code from your Archivos setting and then just paste that into your WordPress site and boom, your visitors can now navigate through your story web. So it's a great promotional tool. It's a great story wiki if you want to entice people to get into your world.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I saw just in looking through that there are pictures for the characters and stuff. Are there pictures for everything? Like, can you make it that visual?
Oh, absolutely. There's a basic, there's a core photo that's used as like the avatar in the story web itself. But every single story element, every character, every event, every place, whatever, they can have a full media gallery that includes images, that includes PDFs or RTFs, or even links to YouTube videos or audio. So you can create a full multimedia experience around your core characters, or, you know, if you have a visual palette of what this place looks like, you can upload the images of that palette and have that be a part of the story elements profile on the Archivos interface.
That is amazing.
You can't see me right now, but my mouth is hanging up. I'm not sure if I'm flabbergasted or salivating, but it's one of those.
Well, and interestingly enough, I just got done talking to the developers of Archivos because it's been dormant for about a year now as I was dealing with some personal stuff at home. But I'm getting ready to fire it back up again. One of the features that we're looking at is to be able to import story elements from like an Excel spreadsheet or a Google Doc. So one of the biggest challenges I think for new story worlds is it's a little labor intensive on the front side, entering the data and creating the elements. So we wanted to take some of that away. So now you'll be able to import an Excel spreadsheet that had all of that information, and Archivos will automatically parse it out into the various story elements that you need.
Okay.
That'll help expedite input. We're also going to set up
our character spreadsheet.
Well, not only that, but you know how I've been creating an elements database spreadsheet for each of our code things where we've assigned, like, is it a place? Is it a person?
Oh my God.
And we've got notes on it and names and
Perfect. Perfect.
That's awesome good. Because we can just keep updating the Excel spreadsheet that way too.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I have used, for example, Plotter and World Anvil before. So I know that there are big databases out there that, at least having not, you know, seen Archivos yet, sort of have a similar style of creating your elements and doing builds from it. So how would you say that Archivos is different, is better than some of those that I was familiar with previously?
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, while I was developing Archivos and Archivos was just coming out, World Anvil was just coming out. And initially I looked at them and I go, oh God, really? Really? Man, this is a whole new idea. And very much World Anvil is very much occupying that same space.
Okay.
The big difference that I'm seeing between Archivos and World Anvil is World Anvil has chosen to very much occupy that gamer space. You can certainly tell stories and create fiction in there, but their orientation is a little bit more towards the gamer side of things. And they're also very much into providing you with every option possible, which is fabulous. And I absolutely support it. It's an astonishing tool. We're kind of taking the other side of things, and we want to provide you with, I guess, the opportunity to customize and create your own. Rather than give you a comprehensive list of all the things, we're going to give you a more pared down list of more conceptual things that you can then define for your unique story in your unique setting.
Okay.
So in that regard, I honestly don't think Archivos is better than World Anvil by any stretch of the imagination. World Anvil is an incredible tool. And honestly, I suggest people check it out because it does blow your mind. I think Archivos provides a different narrative reinforcement in terms of the visualizations that we provide and also just the way that you organize and structure things in the context of that story world.
Okay.
But we're also looking at expanding to include things like, well, first of all, outputting. If this is going to be a story Bible and you want to hand it out to people that maybe don't use the computer so often, being able to output your story world in a legible text format that you can distribute to other people. We're going to provide that as well.
That would be really useful. Like, say if you are an agented author and you're going through traditional publishing and you, and they're asking for resources, you can say, oh, here, and you can just export it and say, here you go, editor and copy editor and people that are going to be doing my continuity and stuff. Here is the World Bible.
Yeah, exactly. Here are all the characters, here are all the locations, and it'll list the connections. You won't actually, it'll be paper, so you can't really connect them, but you'll be able to see the different connections described in the text. So yeah, absolutely. And we also, I'm really excited about the notion of being able to tag your story elements and the ability to say like, these events are tagged to chapter one. These events are tagged to chapter two, or this particular a movement. These people belong to this organization or this philosophy or this ideology. And then being able to either highlight a specific tag through color or shape within the display, or filter the display to only show the elements linked or associated with that particular tag. So you can literally create a different view of that network based on how you've defined and set up your tags. So much more down the pipe, but that's our initial, that's the next round of development for Archivos that we're looking at.
Well, I'm super excited to get in there and start playing. I encourage listeners, go take a look at it, sign up for the free version of it, and look around. Maybe you'll find some of the story soil worlds and cultures available in Archivos soon too. So speaking of, let's get brainstorming.
Brainstorm, baby. Yes.
But first, a disclaimer. Disclaim.
The disclaim shall be, remember, friends, ideas are cheap and you can't put them back in the bag. You're encouraged to use these ideas and world seeds to write your own story. We only ask that if you do, toss us a shout out in the acknowledgements or the author's note.
This has been the disclaimer.
You have been disclaimed. Go forth.
Yes. Which is not the same as being unclaimed.
Does anybody have any ideas, any concepts that have sprung on them suddenly? I'm still stuck on cocaine mummies.
I mean, in the taking of the notes, there were a couple of things that sort of stood out to me as interesting things to play with. One of them was the smuggling of drugs in ancient shit.
Okay, I kind of loved that too.
Which could certainly be an element. I was also very interested in sort of this idea of cultural telephone and the carrying of language by the common folk. So, and then also the concept of like this chain, these links of a chain and a trade route and what happens along that. So, you know, if we think about maybe, I mean, my brain does go to fantasy. And so then I think about we do so much in fantasy, we do so much with the kingdom and its couple neighbors. So the concept of exploring not the kingdom and not the neighboring kingdom, but actually building the world from the perspective of that long chain, like there's a kingdom far to this way and a kingdom far to this way. And then what is occurring along the cross-continental train route, the little trade route, the little towns, the cultures that are blending and mixing, the people that only know the person before them in the chain and after them in the chain, and sort of building that sort of long culture element.
Yeah.
So yeah. I like the idea of like some cultural elements that are passed up and down that chain. I also really loved the idea where you had that one place that was like, nope, trade stops right here. We'll take it over from here. Like, you shall not pass. We get all the money. We hike up all the profits.
Yep. Yep.
And we can use both of those ideas, I think. Well, Dave, anything that stood out to you?
Well, one of the things that struck me, a hundred things struck me, but one of the things that really lodged in my brain was Sarah describing these massive barges of grain going from Egypt up to Rome. And I'm thinking about pirates. And, you know,
grain pirates.
Well, no, that's the thing. What pirate is going to take over a grain ship? You know, pirates, they're going after the big score. So the guy who decides I'm going to be a grain merchant is playing it safe. You know, he's going, no, I'm good. I don't want the big score. I'm just going to take this big thing of grain that no one's going to mess with. But it's like, but I'm not carrying myrrh. I'm not carrying silk. You can't trade this for big bucks. You know,
so if you hold it up for too long and you can't move the product, it'll go moldy. Have fun.
Exactly. Right. So, and it's like, yeah. But the other thought was that, you know, Rome needed that stuff. Rome would like freaking, well, they had a lot of people bringing them food and stuff, but these massive big cities, they are not sustainable.
No.
Especially in medieval times, if we're looking at fantasy. And even in science fiction, you know, space station out in the middle of space, again, not sustainable. So you've got this very clear, not just, boy, I would sure like some pepper on my paprika, but it's like
pepper on my paprika.
I just need some freaking air and some water. You know, so you've got those in order to survive needs, like grain coming up from Egypt, as well as the silk and the pepper and the cumin seeds coming from Asia.
Some pepper on my Parthian chicken.
Can I tell you guys like a really funny quick story about like food trade in medieval cities?
Yes, please.
Yes.
Okay, so like the Low Countries, Netherlands and Belgium, had a lot of like urban textile centers, like in the Middle Ages, like big industrialized cities. They just didn't have automation yet. They had like huge textile workshops, single women just living their lives, craziness. And that there are a lot of reasons that the Netherlands have like really concentrated, like high production, you know, per acre agriculture. That is one of them, is that they had big industrialized cities before any of the stuff we associate with like modern technology, right? So they had like the mills to like pump water out of the polders and everything. And because of that heritage of like, what you would call it, like it's basically urban agriculture. Like they had farms like right up close to the city. You had a lot of people who go work in the city for 5 or 10 years, go back home to the farm. There wasn't really, I don't say the urban rural divide is made up. Like that's a whole thing. Like it is not what people think it is. But like they, like there was just a whole lot more interconnection because like physically they were closer together, just like lifestyle wise, they were just, people would readily go back and forth between the two. Because of that heritage of that, like that's part of how the greenhouse industry came to be. And that intense greenhouse industry and like having all of that food production capability really close to the cities instead of depending on long-term imports is why the Netherlands lived through World War II.
Interesting.
Yeah, like one of the Nazi strategy was like, oh, this stupid country doesn't respect us. Let's just starve them to death. And it didn't really work because don't eat tulips. They are toxic. You have to like go to some lengths to prepare them properly. But like the Netherlands just had so many fucking tulips sitting around that they never got around to planting because they're like, oh, the Nazis just took over. The flower trade is not happening this year. That they were like, that's why they had that much stuff around to eat, was because they were doing urban agriculture and they had been doing it for hundreds of years.
There you go.
That's pretty awesome.
Not trade. The opposite of trade. Anyway,
I had two thoughts. One, if we want to develop something that can exist along these links, I think we should come up with our focus should be a group that does trade, like a guild or a culture or even a company, some kind of company that created itself, but they have leave to go through the different borders and stuff. And then I have forgotten my second idea, but Adrian, it looks like you have something to say.
Yes, I've been squirming for like 5 minutes.
Sorry. Sorry. I'm squirming because I have to pee, but you have to say something. So go for it.
No, I've been listening to what people were saying, and my brain is doing the synthesis thing that I can put all of these things in one thing if I try really hard.
Okay. I'm ready.
Okay,
I'm ready.
Okay, right?
Synthesize.
Right? Okay. So you've got a big river Yes. And so we're talking, you know, Mississippi level, Nile level. So huge trade route river, right? And so it's going one direction. And then you've got the land trade route from distant kingdom A to distant kingdom B, which is all of the little chains and links and trade hubs and vendors that buy from vendors that buy from vendors that upcharge and buy to more vendors. And then right where those two cross in a vaguely perpendicular fashion, you have got a giant city that has spawned that is essentially its own territorial city state that sits there on the confluence and says, and we be the gatekeepers. and so they basically are intaking, you know, from passage rights to who can and can't fend to, you know, obviously they don't want to cause such a big problem that every single other cog in this machine decides to crack down on them, but they also provide, you know, services and rest and all of this other stuff. And
they're rich.
They're ridiculously rich. And because there's the huge river, that could be where the grain barges are. So you can have like, and maybe it's near the mouth of an ocean, who knows? Because you want grain pirates. And for that, we need water. For the chain thing, we need like a land route. So here we have, and Scribe said she's interested in the gatekeeper country. So bam, I put all your things together. It's
and the city has a drug problem.
Oh, yes, they do.
They don't know how the drugs are getting in. It's coke mummies.
Well, I mean, of course there's a drug problem.
Duh.
And it's smuggled. They check all the common things like the urns and the vats and the jewelry and the. There are things you don't think of, old artifacts, unearthed things, sealed things, dead bodies. Like, yes. So then you can build this whole, and this city would be such an amalgamation of culture, the number of languages spoken, the conflicting, you know, the cultural conflicts, the people stepping on each other's toes. And so from a world building perspective on a large scale, from whatever, you know, a listener chose to riff off of it, you could focus more on your people being from Kingdom A in the Far East, from Kingdom B in the Far West, you know, in the pirate line of work, in the grain trade line of work, the peacekeeper who's just been hired to try to keep order. And it's like, this is just so overwhelming.
Let me ask a question. This is a devil's advocate question, but
Adrian, you're not the devil's advocate this time.
This is so confusing to me.
What prevents Kingdom A, B, or C from conquering the city and saying this city is ours, and now all the trade comes through us?
That is a very good question. How did Parthian survive so long, Sarah?
You know, I'm actually scrolling through the Wikipedia site right now, and I haven't gotten to the why it stopped happening thing. So I'll let you know in a minute.
My guess is, like, you accrue a little money, then you find a way to protect that money. So they probably are in the practice of hiring, you know, you hire the mercenaries to protect your trade caravan. But, you know, they have this probably fairly robust city guard that can be created from Divinthian soldiers. They are the finest in the land. We have bought 800 of them. They are our slaves. Like,
and you learn to play both sides. You learn to sell yourself to the one side as you're having these issues, but we can help neutralize that, and vice versa to the other side. And if they were essentially, because they're not like the only other kingdom along the way. It's a long chain full of tons of little kingdoms and towns and principalities. So they just happen to be the ones that really had some sort of vision for, we've got this confluence, and just ran with it. And now they've positioned themselves to be just valuable enough to everyone that if any one of those people, you know, entities chose to come after them, the others would probably help protect their interests. Mm-hmm. And when all of these places are distant and have their own problems, they're probably not going to band together against them. So it's a very delicate game. It would have taken time to build. but a delicate balancing act of politics and bribery and passive threats and you know, sucking up.
Let's give them a history. I absolutely agree with that, but let's give them a history to justify that ability. Let's say that maybe once or twice the city has been conquered and the disruption of trade created catastrophic effects on a cascade of deficit and hunger and privation on down the road. And so immediately, you know, country B responds and then country C, and they're all fighting, and then they're all fighting in the city. And then they just kind of stopped fighting. The war is still going on. They still can, but nobody's drawing blood. Nobody's fighting. They're all in the city. They all have their embassies and their little quarters and quadrants, and they're all still navigating for control. But instead of swords and bloodshed, it's deception and intrigue.
And somehow the city navigates how to come up and on top, because they're like, guys, for a whole year, y'all couldn't put pepper on your steak.
Yes.
Wasn't our fault. If people had left us alone, you'd be having seasoned meat.
Well, and this is where Lauren's sacred negotiators and tradesmen come into play. You know, at some point while the fighting was in the streets and at the worst, you know, some visionary person spoke up and Matt managed to at least calm everybody down and then became the spark of not unity, but certainly the mechanism of harmony within this confines. And because they did that, they became like Switzerland. And now these people, these agents of this organization, they are there to facilitate trade across, you know, maybe not globally, but certainly for hundreds of miles in all direction. They are known as the tradesfolk or whatever.
And I like the idea of the city having gone through a couple of conquerings, having been sacked a few times, and then seeing that in the architecture where things like the city was brought down to, I mean, if you go to the Colosseum now, you see all of these chunks of rock that have been taken out and you see these things that have been done. So like having this, almost this base layer of really old weathered stuff that comes from the original version of this city. And then on top of that, something slightly newer. And then as you build, new buildings or you build or polish up the facades of things, you get these different layers, like layers of fresco here that are unearthed. So they're unearthing their own history sometimes as well.
Well, and
that can be another thing that's peddled.
The building materials of each invested country would manifest in those periods, that those layers of growth. We use terracotta. Ah, well, then that was clearly from, you know, the 12th century when
this is limestone.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the fresco. Here's the limestone.
So you can see the culture and art as well in the decorations and the styles. Something's more gothic. Something else has like those fish scale roof tiles and
Another question for Sarah, how long does something like this sustain? So I mean, I know the Silk Road, like you said, it had two resurgences and it was really around for a very long time, but some of these big cities hubs that built up, were they 100 years, 1,000 years? Like,
okay, so
okay, so here we go.
So, okay, so like, for example, you have cities like Babylon, which was a thing until like the Middle Ages, and it just kind of like just faded as trade routes changed. Like this, just the directions that stuff moved like changed such that it wasn't as much of a stopping point anymore. So that's what did in Babylon. It's like, what, a 4,000-year-old city, and it finally went away like 1,400 years ago. You know, so that was a thing until pretty recently. Jericho is funny because we talk about it all the time as like the oldest continuously inhabited city, except there were whole centuries in Jericho's history when it was abandoned. It actually moved a couple times, and so it's that's kind of funny to me.
Oops.
Okay, you grab that side. I'll grab this side. We're going over the other side of the river. Here we go. Moving the city.
Whoop,
right? Like the city of Troy famously like was built and rebuilt mm-hmm. and burned down several times.
Ilium.
Yeah, let's see. It was around until pretty recently. And like, in fact, the people who lived around there were like, yeah, this is where Troy was. And people were like, nah, that's just a story from myth.
Well, and they've thought they've found Troy so many times.
Mm-hmm. And then they did.
Yeah. I would imagine disruptive technologies. Like, I think part of the reason the Silk Road lost some of its preeminence was because people got good enough at sailing that they didn't need mm-hmm. to look at the coastline anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So they could actually get from China to, Arabia without having to pay so much damn tax and mm-hmm. be attacked by bandits and blah, 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 blah. You made a lot more money. It was a much more profitable thing to do it by sail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So quick going back to, you guys had a question about what happened to the Parthian Empire. So I figured it out.
Yes.
Basically, like, just a long time of conflict with Rome. So this is a fun story. So, like, a lot of the peoples kind of in the middle of the Silk Road, it was arid grasslands, right? So you don't have, like, the settled urban civilizations were in river valleys, and you don't have rivers kind of so much in the middle, right? So mm-hmm. you have basically a lot of horse and camel riding steppe nomads. And so that's part of why they played such a key role as the center parts of the Silk Road, is like they were already going around all over the place anyway. You might as well take some silk with you, right? So that was like a big part
when you're a Mongol.
Yeah, that was a big part of the character of the Silk Road, is it was people who were already like mobile herders for a living. So you might as well stack trade on top of that. So the Parthians had some novel military techniques that the Romans did not know what to do with. So they had,
oh shit, they're not using hoplite phalanx. What do we do?
Yes. And they weren't using chariots either. They were just like mounted archers, and they had stirrups, which meant that they could fire a bow from a horse, which was like apparently a little bit new for Rome.
Can I tell you very briefly about the first stirrup?
Sure.
It is literally a string that goes across the horse's back and ties to either big toe.
I love that. I'm like, do you tie that on before you get on the horse or after? That's my question.
It would have to be, you could probably tie it on one toe before you mount up, and then you mount up and get it on the other. I think with your feet tied together, it might be difficult to mount a horse.
That's what
just
I'm feeling.
Theorizing, yeah, there. So
that doesn't,
I could be wrong.
So the Parthians had this tactic they would do where they were like, they would fake a retreat. They'd be like, ah, we're running away on our horses. We're running away so fast. And the Romans were stupid, so they hadn't seen this before. And they're like, go get them. Like, go run after them. Like, break out of our, like, phalanx formation. And, like, go chase, I don't know, with chariots or something. And then because they had stirrups, they could turn around in the saddle and fire behind them. And just, like, shoot them full of arrows. And the Romans were like, ah, oh my god, I've been betrayed. So they called this the Parthian retreat. It's a fake move. And then you're like, ha ha, pew, 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 suckers. So it took
Parthian retreat is how I want to leave every room from now on. Pew, 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 suckers.
So that's how
just, like,
call.
Turn around and be like, by the way, the pew, food pew, sucks, pew. And then twirl and leave.
So that's, like, literally, like, a Parthian retreat is, like, a thing that they call when you, like, say something super bitchy on your way out of a room and everybody's just like,
like, I am here for it. I am ready.
Yeah, I'm on Wikipedia. As metaphor, the term Parthian shot is also used as a metaphor to describe a barbed insult delivered as the speaker departs.
Boom. We all feel it, right? So it took Rome a while to figure out what to do about this, right? So, like, they had to, like, change their military tactics somewhat. So they had kind of, like, an agreed upon border for a long time, like, at the Euphrates River. And then eventually mm-hmm. Rome being Rome was like, nah, we're going to take you over. So, like,
sounds very Rome.
And it wasn't super successful. They were just, like, border fighting all the time until they'd just been fighting for so long that the Parthian Empire was just weakened. There might have been multiple rulers. There's kind of, like, a split happening. And then actually,
not enough tulips.
The royal line of Parthia actually lived on for a long time as rulers in Georgia and Armenia for, like, centuries after that. So it didn't really disappear so much as fall apart and move kind of a little bit. But yeah, that's what happened.
Hmm. Well, it's good to know how a kingdom, how an empire can fade. I mean, that's because
yeah.
I think, Adrian, that's what you were referring to is how long would this city remain in this delicate balance of control and vying for power.
Right. And when we're talking about how many potential wars it's been through and how far back you're seeing some elements of that in the city, would it be even reasonable to think that it had been there long enough for all of that? Or is it somewhat transient in the grand scheme of history and just happens to kind of be the moment that our world currently exists in? I always like to think about, you know, where are some of these play elements for people who are using this as inspiration? You know, obviously anywhere you want them to be, but my brain goes to a version of this where, you know, it's a slow evolution of they were just a tiny little kingdom and it grew on its own and at some point took on a personality. A version where it is this big established central hub that does have layers and layers of building and ruin and building and ruin. So many ways to handle the situation.
Yeah.
I also think it might be neat if the city were in an abandoned state, but trade was still going through it. That would be really creepy.
That would be creepy.
It wouldn't stay abandoned long if trade were going through it because someone would set up a snapshot.
Unless. Magic.
Curse.
Magic, curse. Bandits.
Magical cursed bandits.
Magically cursed bandits.
I'm thinking like, so, okay, the kingdom is being sacked, right? And the last people to occupy it had access to some powerful magic that they just basically put a curse on it and said, no one shall live here.
Boom.
No one in this city shall profit from trade
so
here.
So it's like a sundown town for everyone.
Yeah.
You can't sleep there. You have to go through, and it's more than a day's travel between this cursed region. So anybody who sleeps there becomes cursed, becomes a part of this dark.
Well, you can. Like, there's a limit on the nights. There's a limit to what you can do. You can pass through. You can be transient. You can't
sleep.
Like she said, live there. Create.
You can't stay still.
You can't sleep in three nights or whatever. Yes.
Yeah, you can't put down roots, build a house. You can't, you know, start to put up a shop. You can't get profit within the zone. Like, you can't have a subsistence there. Yeah.
No. You cannot exchange things.
You can't set foot on the ground. Anyone whose bare foot touches the ground becomes tainted.
Or anyone who is on the ground if you breathe the air for more than three nights, you can't leave.
Yeah, it's like fae. It's like fairy. And then the people that did do that, they become the local inhabitants.
They become the grain pirates.
Grain pirates, yes. And I just want to point out, this doesn't have to be out near the main city. We were building a world. That could be the next city over, you know.
Yeah, it could be a separate place.
Yes, exactly.
So if we think about the whole, you can't, quote unquote, live there, right? And we don't so much take off, because magic interprets things weirdly, right? Mm-hmm. And we take off like a time limit or some of those things, and we just go with the whole trading, setting up staying in one place for a super long period of time, et cetera, et cetera. What about the person being chased in hiding who comes in and has figured out how to trick it into thinking they're not permanent for like 3 years? They just never stay within 5 miles of each other for like more than 2 days. They haven't built anything. They've never exchanged anything with anyone. They've basically figured out how to game the system by seeming temporary by the magic standards for the 3 years they've been hiding there, because no one would think to look for them there.
And
I love that as a character.
My one character, why not a band, a merry band of?
Oh, I mean, that could be the character that started it and then met somebody else and said, here, let me teach you how.
And they've had to be very careful not to hand each other things while in there, like not to.
Yeah.
They have to split up occasionally because it sort of starts to think, wait, the same people sleeping in the same place for a long time. Like, they have to kind of mix it up constantly.
I do kind of love the idea of all those people like turning into stone in that sort of way. where you kind of calcify it, and they say you'll become part of the city, and people think that means, oh, you're gonna just, you're never gonna be able to leave. But literally it means like you become part of the city.
There you go. There you go. And I'm always kind of trying to put a science spin on the magic. So it's a disease or a contagion that's like out of Game of Thrones, where you become this sort of troll-like creature that eventually is destined to become this calcified rock thing as your body slowly grinds to dust. But during that brief span of time, while you're still ambulatory, but your mind is gone, you become you become a ravager, and that's another hazard by taking this road. But of course, this is the only way to get from Kingdom X to Kingdom Q. So you have to go through this area, which is why all the crap from Kingdom X is so damned expensive.
Yeah, it would also be funny if there was a version of it where it's, I mean, it seems so safe. There aren't extra threats there. It's not like weird and dark. It's not uninviting. It's just a pretty lush place with lots of space because people aren't settled there, and solid old farms that could be rebuilt, and good foundations and nice weather and fertile land.
You just want to lure people into this, don't you?
Just happens to be cursed, but everyone knows it. Everyone knows it.
It is known.
Is it though? Is it really cursed? Because, you know,
we should find
out. We should find out.
Exactly. An extra night won't kill us.
Yeah.
It'll be fine.
Well, and the other thing.
Guys, I was looking up a.
Go ahead.
Quick aside. I was looking up. Okay. So one of the few luxury exports that Rome could actually send the other way back to China was like luxury glass products, because they had like the most advanced tech for that. And okay, so there is a clear glass, like it's hard to make clear glass. They figured out how to do it.
Yeah.
Clear glass cup with like an enameled portrait of a gladiator on it. And it's like super detailed. So you can like actually see what the gladiator outfit looks like. Guess where they found this thing?
China.
Where?
Afghanistan. This exquisite Roman glassware cup in Afghanistan.
Because there was like,
yeah, there's like a Greek kingdom in Afghanistan for a while. So,
wow.
Well, and that's the other thing, just from a world building standpoint, is that I think it would be very important to designate very specifically what resources are cherished and prized by each kingdom and why. And then position the other kingdoms to be able to provide. So you have this very clear supply and demand dynamic dialogue transaction going on.
And especially if you have these kingdoms, like some of your far-flung kingdoms are in, could be in areas where it's more difficult to grow food, but it's really easy to mine precious metals. Yep. And you can have other little island kingdoms that are like, we don't, what is a cow? I don't know what a cow is. Here, have a chicken.
And so they are in the business of shipping giant barges of wheat up the river.
Exactly.
I'm just trying to imagine, like, what is the life of like a middle of the Silk Road pack animal merchant whose main product is glass?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Can you imagine? That must have been horrible.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, if they're a pack animal merchant, you know, they need to have a resource for pack animals. They've got to be able to have some sort of capital they can use to buy the glass coming from the West. So they're trading with the local merchants and getting silk from the Mongols coming down. Yeah, I carry silk because, you know, I need meat. So here's silk. Give me meat. Yes, great. And blah, blah, blah.
Your Mongol also sounds Russian.
Everything. I know. I'm sorry. Apparently, that is my dialect du jour.
It's like,
and can you imagine you're like climbing up and down the mountains, and then like the camels get spooked or whatever, and you're like, shit, there goes all the glass. Yeah. Like, can you imagine? Yeah. Oh my
Don't
gosh.
Buck.
Yeah. Anyway.
Do not buck. Oh my God.
And you'd have so many mixings. Mm-hmm. Like,
that is all.
Mm.
People, and you determine how much of the chain do they handle, because, you know, if you're buying for this much, then selling it for a little more, and then they buy it for that, then sell it for a little more. Like, the capital sort of does filter backwards. And then that cultural element, like, what if one of these traders, like, that is their entire, and they go further, and they go multiple chains at a time, multiple links in the chain at a time, and you end up in these linguistic kerfuffles and cultural, you know, things that have to be picked up, and then what you bring back with you. And that game of telephone.
I do like the idea of there being like maybe a single merchant family or a single group of people like that have a coalition, or for some reason they have leave to go through so many of the links of the chain. They kind of want to, they kind of go back and forth from one end to the other because they're trying to reap the benefits and follow this money as far as they can.
Okay. A, they would be, I would imagine if there is other trade going on that's scorned or looked, there would be anger and resentment from the conventional merchants who didn't have leave to make those longer branches. And
well, and I also kind of like the idea of these people go like their idea was we're going to make all this money, but they ended up just trading things of the same value just up and down the entire thing, and they're like, it's not working.
But it is. You're alive. You've got a roof over your head and food in your belly. This is a business.
The real earning was the culture and language we traded along the way.
Oh, a moral of the story. Lovely. Well, and the other opportunity for nuance to all of this is, you know, when you're deciding why a resource is valuable, you know, can always throw in a religious or noble or some kind of thing where like the churches, the temples in Egypt wanting lapis lazuli. It's like, you know, lapis lazuli is pretty, but it's a luxury. But no, if I need it to worship Ra, it's not a luxury. I freaking need the lapis lazuli.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've got that whole political, religious, cultural demand going on that can be played for some additional flavor and passion. Yeah.
And it occurs to me that there might, it might not even be that you can't go through part like links of the chain or multiples. Like, what would prevent you? But how many people really want that to be their entire life? Like, it's one thing to say, all right, I'm going to be gone for a month on my leg of the route. I make good money selling it in the next city, but then I get to come back and spend 2 months with my family in my house, you know? So that's why the chain is sort of the way it is, to the next big hub, to sell it, to come back. That's manageable for someone or some family to go out on a limb and say, nope, we're gonna sell everything, buy an RV and take it on the road. Like, that's
why Marco Polo was such a badass. It's like nobody ever thought to go on RV. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, like to go out and back, like that's easily a decade's commitment. Yeah, so that's why Marco Polo was a freak. He was like the first person to be like, no, I'm just going to keep going. Or like at least the first person from Europe to be like, no, I'm just going to keep going. And people were like, huh.
As we discussed, the Polynesians were just like, fuck it, let's go.
We're out.
Here we go. Well, and I figure, you know, either Marco had a spurned lover or a fight with dad, you know, something burned his bridges back there. I do not believe for a second that he set out to go to China. I think he was running from something and said, huh, this could be a good deal. I can get some mileage out of this. Yeah, okay, let's keep going. Let's see what we got.
I'm going to get a book deal.
Exactly, right?
That's what Marco Polo was thinking about. His book deal.
Book deal, miniseries, webcam, yes, all of that.
Stars or HBO or bust. So I also kind of want to think about what are the industries that support these trade routes? What are the things that go into helping these things exist? These way stations, these the different
cocaine.
Yeah, we've got the drug trade. I mean strippers and coke, really. I mean, it's not wrong.
A whole lot of booze, a whole lot of taverns.
And celery. Give me celery. I can't make it.
Give me celery or give me death.
So you got mercenaries, you've got foundries and smiths, cartwrights, definitely inns and taverns.
Breeders, horse breeders, cattle breeders,
yes.
Pack animal breeders, leather workers,
and repairs for all of this along the way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And oh yeah, I can fix anything in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, and you're going to have like the, hey, it's lonely on the road. You want some company, big boy? Like, you've definitely got the, I mean, I pointed out the strippers already, but
the hospitality industry. Yes.
Yes. We'll call it that. We'll the hospitality that. Industry. And no shame either. Like, make some of them awesome.
Yeah.
Make like, I mean,
companion level.
What is it? In Firefly, they have the companions.
Yep.
Yeah. And that would be an interesting thing that changes from culture to culture as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then in medical, you're going to get sick out there. You're going to,
good point.
You're going to break, you know, get injured on the roads and you get into town. You need someone who hopefully isn't a snake oil salesman, mm-hmm. who can actually keep you from dying of
hopefully
infection.
Hopefully you have an Irby space or monk.
Scurvy. So yeah. Yeah.
Well, never. And religious as well, you know, maybe a temple or a shrine maintained by a priest to allow you to still honor your gods in your way, although they're distinctly not liked all that much by the locals because you're not from around here and it's not our gods.
Mm-hmm. So. A non-denominational temple of sorts.
Tiny hubs that are totally out of place and yet people need them.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, the Silk Road is really interesting because people are like pretty ecumenical. They're like, oh yeah, like that's the god that handles that stuff over there. Like, you know what? They sound pretty cool. So there's actually like a cult of this one god Mithras in ancient Rome who like came all the way from India.
Mm-hmm.
And people were like building temples to him. And it was like Romans. It wasn't necessarily travelers. So they were pretty ecumenical. They were just like, hey, I heard this guy over there handles stuff real good. Should we go give him some chickens?
Yeah. When you have pantheons and you're not a monotheistic society, it's real easy to be like, you guys have a god for that? Let me worship that. That's pretty cool. I wanna, yeah, can let me get some of that.
Like, yeah, there's no like non-competes with your deities.
So what I'm hearing
more is more.
That in order for there to be this robust trade, while you can be as discriminatory and intolerant as you want at the extreme end of these roads and trade routes, on the trade route itself, being intolerant is not going to play well with the process of making money.
In the middle, yes. At that hub, yeah, where they cross.
Yep.
Such a fun mm-hmm. melting pot of cultures and exactly. temples. Yeah. And
you got everything.
Exactly. Well, that's kind of like an ongoing source of tension is like when you have settled societies, like, you know, the river civilizations, and especially like mm-hmm. if you're talking feudal times mm-hmm. in a lot of Western Europe, which is where a lot of fantasy comes from.
Mm-hmm.
This is why the classic fantasy setup is like the place and it's three or four neighbors. It's because people didn't really move around that much. They were kind of forced to be sedentary so they could be laborers on somebody's land. It's like a land ownership based civilization. That's where like the economic sustenance came from. And most importantly, that's who the people who are in charge were in charge because they gate kept land.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas kind of in the middle, in the nomadic like parts of that trade route, they were like, you couldn't just sit somewhere and farm, like you would starve. And so the way people made their living was moving around. And so like, you can't acquire power by gatekeeping land. You can't be like, this is my estate. This is my kingdom. So they made their living by controlling trade routes. And they made their livings by having relationships. And they made their living by like, hey, if you're going over there, I know somebody you should bring because they know a lot of people there.
So diplomacy and negotiation.
Yeah. So there's like two conflicting modes of power there, which mm-hmm. is like, an eternal source of conflict. This is why is to that, this day.
Great storytelling.
Is that because area of like those kinds of grasslands and stuff are not super arable or?
Yeah, they're just too dry to reliably grow crops. Okay. And that's like you follow the rains like with your livestock. Mm-hmm. So like this is still a source of tension to this day. Like this is one of my beefs with the local food movement as they're like, people didn't used to trade. And I'm like, fucking hell they did. You just have some Eurocentric biases as how you like you think civilization is supposed to work, and you're like, oh, all this mobility is a newfangled thing, and it's not right. and it's like not kosher somehow.
Yeah.
But we get glass Roman cups in Afghanistan, so fuck you.
Yeah, I actually just found like a glass wine bottle that it was Roman. It was found buried in Germany from like 300 AD, and it looks like halfway between an amphora and a modern wine bottle. It's crazy. Ooh. So that's fun.
Wow.
Germany.
All right. Yeah. So any last little ideas or things that you guys want to add into this build?
No, I'm loving this city. This city is awesome.
I think it's really cool. I think there's a lot of room to play. I mean, there's even room to focus down into one of the kingdoms on either side of it. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to, with this as the wing, deal with what happens if the trade does get cut off. But I think we've pulled in a lot of the features, and there's a lot of play space.
Echoes very strongly with the Thieves World books and Sanctuary. I don't know if you guys have ever read those, but
who's it by? I haven't read those.
Well, it was an anthology of short stories that Robert Asprin and Lynn Abbey curated for many, many years. There's like 8 or 9 collections, but it's this city, and each story takes place from a different perspective of a different person within the city. And over time, you know, invaders come and there's history here and yada, yada. So this evolution of, you know, Adrian, what you were talking about with the how long would it be, you know, with a long enough arc, we could actually see the growth and change and maybe the decline of this great trade city and what would rise up in its place. I think that'd be fascinating.
It would be.
I want to see what happens when the curse breaks on the Eden type city. So maybe we will see this created in Archivos. So keep your eyes out for that. But until next time, friends, go forth and create. And remember, if you write something in these worlds, let us know. We'd love to give you a virtual high five and a shout out. And so would Dave.
Hell yeah.
You guys, I had to look up a lot of like ancient Roman art glass bottles for this.
Oh, what kind of stuff did you find?
It's your new jam.
They just got that like psychedelic trippy, like they like to make stripes. And I'm like, they just got that esprit of bong. Like, they're so tacky.
But did they smoke celery in them?
I don't know about that. They definitely held wine, but you're just like, oh, these are so tacky looking. They're doing their best. It's fine. Do I read the ending disclaimer?
No, not yet. That's at the ending.
Cool. Okay. I'm doing that one, or one of you guys is doing that one?
I'll do that one.
Okay. Okay.
You sprung this disclaimer thing on her so suddenly, Scrap.
I did. But I did not. I clearly. My script was lacking.
No, it's fine. Like, you guys are having such a good time, and I had no idea what was going on, so I was composing a tweet about Stefan from SNL. That's what happened.
She was unprepared.
As you do.
As you do, yeah.
That moment when the teacher calls on you and you weren't really listening to class, and you're like, oh shit, can I read the board fast enough to figure out what's going on?
That kind of happens a lot in the second half, is because I'm like, these guys have it. Like, they know what they're doing. Like, they're actual fiction people. And I'm like, nonfiction. I don't know what's going on. And yeah, anyway.